The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns Gear and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold on the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yep, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill Spend and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Cenovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at Cenovus.com.
Want to make a podcast? Let me tell you about Spotify's program for podcasters, and it's called Spotify for Podcasters. I've been using it for over a year now. Couldn't be happier from the switch. You can record wherever you create podcasts, whether it be your phone, computer, and it's easy to upload it and distribute it to everywhere podcasts are heard. With Spotify for Podcasters, you can earn money in a variety of ways, including ads and podcast subscriptions. Best of all, Spotify for Podcasters is completely free. So launch your podcast today. Get started with Spotify for Podcasters. Go to www.spotify.com/podcasters to get started.
But as soon as I showed up, like we had the nine line and within 90 seconds, we were eyes on and tally target. And then as soon as we came off target, that one's done. He just goes, shift northwest corner of the clearing, steer 151. You've heard this in cast before. It's just like, you don't need to write down anything on the nine line. It's like, I'll feed you the data. It's like, just fly in formation and be ready. And I was like, okay, yeah, I can do that. And then I had a guy at B-Course tell me, he's just like, actually, Flash, to be perfectly honest with you, the only reason you are here is because I cannot physically reach over and hit your pickle butt. I was pretty good. So it didn't go poorly for me as far as learning how to be a Viper pilot all the way up until I got to my time at Osan. And then when I got into the plug, I got absolutely exposed. So that was how I ended up in pilot training, thinking that, man, it's going to be a miracle if I graduate this course and actually get to become a pilot. So a little bit of a different path. I always remember that. I always kind of look at this career that I've had and say that it almost never happened.
Viper 01, be advised, the reciprocated 6002 is still active.
Turn that on.
Next, 16, 16,000,
Viper 1 targeted.
Welcome back, and thanks for listening to the podcast. My guest today is Flash McVay. If you've listened to the Bro Chats, you've heard Flash on there. Flash has flown the A-10, the F-16, and the F-35. He went to weapons school in the F-16 and went back as weapons school instructor, and then transitioned over to the F-35. Quite a smart guy. This is more of his story and the story of how he almost did not become a pilot. So quite interesting to hear Flash's background and some of the things he has done. I think you'll enjoy today's episode. Before we get rolling into that, a couple of admin notes. As always, thanks to my Patreon supporters for making the podcast happen. Flash was kind enough to hang around and share a There I Was story, which is available over on Patreon, and now is also available to Apple Podcast subscribers and Spotify Podcast subscribers. So if you want a little something extra, a story you might only hear in the Squadron Bar, you can check out Flash's There I Was story, as well as the many other There I Was stories available on those platforms. If Patreon and Apple and Spotify aren't your things, no big deal. You still can support the podcast by taking the 6 to 9 seconds and just going over and hitting follow, leaving a 5-star review, and leaving a comment for the ratings review. That helps the podcast get shown to more people. And if you're watching this on YouTube, subscribing, commenting, liking, again, that helps the podcast grow and helps out in more ways than you can imagine. So thank you to those who've just taken the time, if you're liking this content, to go over there and show it. With that being said, let's get into the podcast with Flash. Dude, Flash, thanks for joining me on the podcast, man. It's good to have you on here.
Oh, Rain. No, I appreciate it. It's an honor to be here.
Dude, well, if you have been listening at all to the Bro Chats, you guys might or might not have heard Flash make 2 appearances, which I think is the record, albeit, you know, we only have like 11 of them in the queue. But Flash is a really smart guy. He has an interesting career, and we were going to talk a lot about flying jets and everything in between. But Flash, I want to kick off because lately in the news, there's some stuff going on with a country over in or near like Eastern Europe that stirred up a few things. And lately, or I think it was last week, a drone getting hit by a flanker. What are your thoughts? Like, do you think that was intentional? I mean, we can talk strategic, we can talk tactical. Again, these are just some random opinions, but when you saw that footage, what did you think?
When I saw the footage, wild. Absolutely wild. The MQ-9's got great quality, and watched the entire thing. The fuel dump tactic is not something that I have considered before on an intercept, but it could be a new thing. But initially what I kind of thought about it is, yeah, I think that was really dumb on the side of the pilots, the Russian flanker pilots, in my opinion. I think the take that I have on the entire thing is, looking back across, I like to look at just military history and how near conflicts and proxy conflicts have potentially either started or been avoided. And I think as a fighter pilot in 2023, the kind of like we talked about on the very first Bro Chat that I was on, is like, what does the future war look like? And whether it's going to be major combat operations or whether it's going to be proxy wars or anything of that nature, force on force or anything like that. I think these are the types of things that every fighter pilot has to be aware of, that their own actions are going to have strategic consequences. They're going to hop over operational consequences and go right to strategic consequences. And we as American fighter pilots are hopefully aware of it. Hopefully the other side that we are in conflict with is also aware of it. And just my thought on the whole thing was how it was conducted was, I doubt that that was directed by any sort of upper echelon authority. If it was, then sounds great. That I would prefer they did not do that.
Right.
Based on some of the things, and we've seen this before, like one of the things that, and me and my brother were talking about it. My brother, he's a professor at Naval War College. We talked about these kind of things. But another thing was, like, in the Cuban Missile Crisis, is the Cuban government directed the shoot down of the U-2 about 12 days into the crisis. And then we put Minutemen ICBMs on alert pointed at Russia. And so when you're looking at the people that are just a part of these conflicts, in this case, 2 fighter pilots, their action, unintentional, because I don't think he would like to hit another aircraft, So I hope that the midair was actually unintentional. These things can have just massive strategic implications. And that's something you have to be aware of. And I thought overall, the tactic that they elected to choose was obviously pretty irresponsible. And then you could just have some massive world ramifications on the world that we didn't anticipate nor want. Because at the moment, we are still kind of just supplying and working with Ukraine in their war against Russia. But if that were to happen against a manned aircraft, that would go sideways in a hurry. So I just hope that kind of stuff just gets knocked off pretty quick.
It is a good point because, you know, it could be a 26-year-old. I don't know what the structure of the Russian Air Force is, right? But let's take your one each fighter squadron in the United States or Europe or, you know, Western world. Very well, the average age inside that formation is somewhere around 26, 27, 28 years old. And the ramifications for a wild action can send a world into World War III. So again, you hope that it was just a reckless action. And looking at it, like to me, that's what I would think, because what pilot wants to hit another aircraft? And if you're going to take down a drone, I mean, where that happened in the world, I think you probably very easily could have hung back at a few miles and slung a missile at it, and you have taken it out, and it'd been very difficult for anyone to prove that the drone just didn't go lost link and ditch into the sea, you know? So taking all those risks to actually take down a drone in such an inefficient manner is wild.
And that's, I agree. The whole thing is absolutely a insane case study in just how things can go. And when you don't really have a plan with the two sides. And so when we don't really have a plan on how we want to handle escalation in the Ukraine-Russia conflict, is if we don't necessarily have a plan for that, then these are the types of things that can go sideways quick, because if we're not able to just stop, it's like, nope, you know what? That's not according to plan. We can have this in a diplomat, we can handle this in a diplomatic way, then we can avoid these major conflicts. It was kind of like on the second bro chat that I was on, when we talked about shooting down balloons, is I was concerned about if we shot down a balloon or any sort of suborbital ISR, that would open up our suborbital ISR to certain things that other countries could be like, okay, well, now if there's somebody that is spying on us, we can shoot it down. Right. Are we allowed to do that now? Obviously, this situation is massively different between the two sides of on like an actual aircraft versus a balloon, even though we could make arguments all day long. But I mean, the game is changing. And we just want to be on the right side and be able to say and have a leg to stand on to say that what we're doing is correct and that they were the irresponsible ones, which I think it is in this case, on just a tactic that was just two fighter pilots trying to do something. They were probably told to upper echelon, go intercept this thing. Don't dump fuel on it and run into it. probably didn't need to be said, but maybe that's something that was said in their pilot meeting on a Friday or something. Or something like that.
We're going to need to debrief this one, fellas.
Yeah, the
fuel dump on it, now that everyone in the world has watched the fuel dumping flanker, you can obviously see, I think, how inefficient that was. And then if the camera hadn't even been staring at it, like, what are you trying to do? Like, even if you hit it with fuel, like, it's still going to see you.
It's just a thing. I don't know. But
the interesting part of it too, I did see that they're going to be awarded some kind of Russian medal for something. But I think in the face of saving things and then Putin becoming an international war criminal, all in the same, it's been a busy weekend, you know?
Busy weekend.
Things are changing fast, you know?
Absolutely.
Well, Flash, I appreciate your take on that. Again, it's interesting. And again, with that too, it's like, no one really knows, only those two dudes sitting inside the cockpit, and then depending on what transpired between them and their upper echelon. But looking at it, it just seems like this is a super inefficient way, if you wanted to take down a drone, to collide with it and then allow the world to watch you do it via high-definition footage, you know? So
yeah, exactly.
Hindsight. Well, dude, I want to jump back into really what got you involved in flying, what got your path into the Air Force. Where did it all start for you?
Oh, man. Well, so I'm from a military family. My uncle, my dad, going back to my grandpa was also in the Army Guard. But my uncle, my dad, and my brother all graduated from the Air Force Academy, 75, 77, and 2003. So I was familiar with the Air Force Academy, visited there a ton of times, massive Air Force Academy football fan. And that was actually the big reason I wanted to go, is I wanted to play football there. I'm not very good. I was not very good at football, and I'm still not, even more washed up now. But I really wanted to go there to play football. I wasn't recruited, so I was I sent some film in and was a walk-on, but ended up making the team and got to play for a little while. And we'll circle back. I'll turn into the story here in a minute. But as far as I joke around to a lot of people, is I joined the Air Force to play football. And then that didn't really work out. The reason it didn't work out was because I wasn't a very disciplined kid. So when I got to the academy, away from my parents for the first time, and no one was forcing you to do your homework. And as it turns out, the Air Force Academy will just let you fail, and they'll kick you out. So that almost happened. But as far as like getting involved in flying, I didn't necessarily go to the academy to become a pilot. It was something that if it came my way, that would be what I would do. So showing up to the academy in 2005, it wasn't necessarily on my radar to go fly airplanes for the Air Force, even though that's what my family had done. But then as far as just kind of going through it, once I was done playing football, which wasn't very long into my time, about a year and a half, I tried to transfer, tried to leave, tried to quit the Air Force Academy on two occasions. Once to, again, transfer to go play football, and then the other one was just because I didn't really like it. So I didn't know if I was going to show up junior year, first day of class for commitment. But then realized that, like, this is an opportunity. This is a good path. I saw the life that my dad provided for his family. It's a honorable profession, and things like that. And then I actually did it start to enjoy the Air Force Academy and the Air Force way of life, if you will. And then I did get interested in flying. So I went to class, decided to finish out the last 2 years, become an officer, all the stuff. We were going to go. Then obviously jobs come out about end of junior year. I was not ranked very highly in my Air Force Academy class. But as far as, because of that whole undisciplined thing, my GPA was very low to start my time. So, and it was hard to recover from that. So my class ranking was not very high. So I was not going to get my first choice of jobs. So I was given logistics. So I was going to be a logistics officer for my junior year at the academy. Put myself down on the wait list for a rated position. And then about, I would say 150 days from graduation, because 100 night, you actually find out where you're going and things of that nature. I got an opportunity to be a CISO, combat systems officer. So backseat of a Strike Eagle, back end of a C-130, back end of an AC-130, navigator on any of the bigger airplanes. And then, oh, by the way, if you still wanted to be a pilot, you have to take that spot on the wait list, or else you're off the rated wait list for good. So it was a take or no, and then you'll be a logistics officer. So I took it, of course. So on Hunter's night, I was still a navigator, CISO, and then 10 days before graduation, I finished my finals, went home, just took some leave, because you can, waiting to graduate. And I'm sitting in the parking lot of the YMCA, which is where we worked out, me and my family. And I got a phone call from my AMT, Academy Military Trainer. So our Master Sergeant, Master Sergeant Molina, and Jerry Molina, he was a crew chief on the Thunderbirds, actually, before he was at Academy AMT. And he said, "Hey, we got some bad news about your graduation. You're in a little bit of trouble. We need you to get on the first flight back to Colorado." And I've been in trouble before at the Air Force Academy, so this is not an implausible situation. I was like, "Oh no, what happened? What did I do? What did I do this time?" Was actually the question that came out. He's like, "Well, I'm going to put you on with Major Wood, so Paul Wood, call sign Morning, B1 weapons officer, great guy. Didn't appreciate him when I was there. Definitely appreciate him now." He just goes, yeah, man, we just got a little bit of a problem with graduation. We got to change your assignment. You're not going to be a CISO anymore. You're going to be a pilot. So about 10 days before graduation, I got my pilot slot to Del Rio, Texas. I graduated, went on 60 days of leave, reported to Del Rio, and kind of showed up, was told when I first went to the student squadron, hey, don't take any leave because you start pilot training in like 3 weeks. And I was like, I don't start pilot training until next March. And it's currently August something. And they go, nah, you got moved up to September. So I was one of the only academy folks in my class with two other just me and two other academy dudes from my class with about 32 other humans going through pilot training. And that's kind of how I started pilot training. So that was the path, like going to pilot training was, didn't really go to the academy to be a pilot. Got my pilot slot 10 days before graduation. Whirlwind, get down to Laughlin, and then get started pretty much right away. And then I just remember on the first day of pilot training, which is that when I had to go back to IFS, which is a story in itself. I'll tell in a second if you want to hear it. But I was like, I'll be the guy that flies RC-135s to Offutt and just go back home to Nebraska if I can get through this course. I was like, I need all of your guys' help. So if I can get through it, I'll take the RC-135. Because when I went to IFS at Pueblo, I did not do well. So I really? Was not, and still am not, the most gifted of pilots. but flying, I'd never flown an airplane before. Like, I'd never been in a military aircraft, and let alone this DA-20. And I think we talked about it on a bro chat, but I couldn't slip to land. So, like, this one single maneuver, couldn't slip. Busted my check ride for it, busted my second check ride for it with the Air Force, and a captain, green bag, Air Force guy at DOS told me, hey man, you know what this means, that we're very sorry, but you're not going to graduate this course. And then he's like, I'm going to go tell the squadron commander. And literally they have a 20-minute conversation. I'm sitting in the chair, and Lieutenant Colonel Robert Tillman, he walks out, squadron commander, and just goes, hey, you know what, we're going to go ahead and waive that maneuver. And I talked to your instructors, and I looked at your grade book, and everything's been going okay, just average. And we think that you should still get the opportunity to be a pilot, not end your pilot career based off one maneuver that you don't normally do in military aircraft. So that was how I ended up in pilot training, thinking that, man, it's going to be a miracle if I graduate this course and actually get to become a pilot. So. A little bit of a different path. I always remember that. I always kind of look at this career that I've had and say that it almost never happened. What would have happened? What, like, all the what if games? But just super thankful for all the opportunities that I was given, and people kind of still believe in me after I gave them every opportunity not to. In all reality,
here's a spoiler alert too for those who haven't followed you on the bro chat or anything. But Flash has not only flown the A-10, the Viper, but now flies the F-35. Weapons officer, been a weapons school instructor. So he's quite talented. And dude, hearing that, there is something that I think if you have the right attitude and like push through it, like sometimes there's someone who's always kind of watching out and helping you. And people also are probably not familiar with IFS. So it's initial flight screening. And that's a program that is predominantly run by civilian instructors, I think, to this day. There are Air Force pilots associated with it, but they're teaching to fly a DA-20, a Diamond 20 or a DA-40 now. It's a screening program. And I remember we were one of the first classes to go through DOS out in Pueblo. And I know, kidding, I think we started with 69 and we washed out. It was like something like 23-25% of the class. So significantly a very high attrition rate. But hey, if you don't get past that, like, you don't even get to pilot training, and in theory, nope. You save money flying cheaper planes than flying a T-6. But man, talk about, you know, just one maneuver that was going to be the kill shot, and then having someone who had enough common sense to say, you know what, like, he's probably going to be okay and figure this out. And if you're flying a RC-135, you're probably not slipping the plane. And by the time you get to that point, you've had enough, you know. And if you are slipping that plane, it's probably not going to end well, but
you could just go.
That's awesome.
You could just go around.
Right. Here's an option. We're steep.
Yeah.
We'll go around and get another approach and landing. They need that for their counters anyway. So
exactly.
Dude, it's cool to hear stories like that. I'm trying to think when I got my pilot slot, there was only, so I got out of ROTC, but out of the seven commissioning, only two of us had pilot slots. And then towards the end, I'm assuming it's happening like due to medical and other reasons where people are washing out, at least in my time period, that, and this was 07. So a few years ahead of you, or a couple years ahead of you, then they got to fill in more people. But I'm thinking like I was maybe starting my FAPE round when you were commissioning. And is it true or not? Because I hear these rumors going back and forth, and this might jump into today, but there are a lot of cadets at the academy that don't want to be pilots. And I feel like it was starting in and around that time period where people didn't want to go to pilot training, one, because the commit was too long, or they wanted to go do space stuff or whatever. Is there any merit to that statement, or do you know anything about that?
100%. There's 1,000 factors. We won't get into even five of them, but but it's absolutely true. It's generational, and not generational as in like the people don't want to be lethal fighter pilots and like all the chest beating and stuff like that. I think it's the same reason that kids don't want to be, or that guys that go into the academy, I hate to call them kids. I was a kid. Younger people than us, Rain.
Right. But, getting old, gray hair.
Yeah, I know. I think the same things of why a cadet doesn't want to be a pilot is the same reason that a major wants to separate from the Air Force. And as far as I think that there's so many more options and so much more personal license and autonomy in the world that people are not just like, I'm going to go to the Air Force Academy and be a pilot and kind of go from there. It's just like, I can go to the Air Force Academy and I can carve out an incredible career for myself as an intel officer. I can carve out an incredible career with follow-on options as an acquisitions officer, or a contracting, logistics, any career field in the Air Force is going to propel you towards options, both having an honorable and very good Air Force career, and then additionally a solid civilian career afterwards. There is off ramps to the private sector and the public sector in all career fields within the military. So I think people are recognizing that. Then there's the commitment. I could be in the Air Force for 5 years as a logistics officer and minimum of 10 from if I started pilot training, like if I graduated pilot training the day I graduated the Air Force Academy, it's 10 years. I think that scares some folks as they want to start something more lucrative than the Air Force. You're not going to get rich being in the military, but they want to start something potentially more lucrative early on in their career. And I think all of those factors play into it. And then also exposure to pilots at the Air Force Academy. Pilot shortage that we'll maybe get into later on that entire story that I just told is why I'm so passionate about development at a younger age. Developing of a younger fighter pilot is because, just like you said, the people that were sitting there just being like, hey, you know what? We're not going to let this one maneuver ruin this kid's flying career. We see potentially something in this guy. I want to go find that kid that doesn't necessarily know he wants to be a pilot yet and show them that this is a path. Not that this is the way, but it is a path that maybe they weren't thinking about that they would enjoy in their life. It's something big. So, by the way, if Lieutenant Colonel Robert Tilney, he's retired, I can't find him. I've been looking. But if you're out there, come find me. You probably don't remember me at all. This is probably just a random Friday for you. My career is owed to that individual.
It's pretty cool. I was talking with my buddy Feed, who is Blue Angel. I interviewed him a few weeks back. His episode hasn't aired yet. Similar story. So he was on the enlisted side in the Navy, floating around on boats and stuff. But he remembers exactly the guy who signed his papers to commission, to send him the O route, which is just really cool to hear. Like someone who has such a pivotal impact and vector on your, I mean, it's life changing, right? You'd be completely, no telling what you probably, on Wall Street or something like that, living in the Bahamas. So, but yeah, it worked out great for you, Flash. Look at you now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, it has worked out. Obviously, I mean, I've had some career stuff, especially recently, but I mean, it's one of those where it's just a journey, and it's been a good one. And I have always said that I've hoped that I made it worth that dude's ink to sign the grade sheet saying I passed. And I was like, and if I was able to pay it forward and all these different things, just like you have, like, and all those things, like, you've had the exact same, a few of the same similar experiences that I've had.
Right.
And like, your impact on people in aviation is incredible. And so you just want to make it worth the people's time that gave you the opportunity. And that's the biggest thing.
Yeah, 100%. I had some people who definitely looked out for me along the way and guided me. Because otherwise, I was a kid who was like, yep, yeah, bounce around, like, maybe you should go do that. Maybe even like, oh, okay, that seems kind of cool. But they put the bumpers up and they helped kind of pull me along, which I would not be here today without several key mentors and sidewalls, if you will.
Absolutely.
To keep me moving down the path. So Absolutely. You graduate pilot training. That obviously goes fairly well because you go into the Mighty Hog.
Absolutely.
You did one assignment in the Hog, correct?
I did. Huh? So just one operational assignment after B course. So B course, Davis Monthan, my one operational is at Moody.
Did you do a full assignment at Moody? And did you deploy
in the Hog? I sure did not. the less than minute story on that one is like, I show up to Moody on April Fool's Day, 2012. 74th okay. Fighter Squadron and Thunder to that. Man, that squadron was awesome. Like I'll say it's like the humans that were in that if as far as developing as a young fighter pilot, that was where you wanted to be. But they had just gotten back from a deployment, and it was like the young flight leads turn IPs that just come back from that deployment that became the old heads like to go on this next one. So we were slated again. So I did the whole, upgrade, just one, flight lead in about 8 months after I got there, just to deploy. So we deployed in March of 2013. So a little less than a year after I showed up and went downrange, have some great stories, as far, at least I think they're great, stories that are told poorly that had an impact on me. But but as far as going down range and learning, had a couple. I mean, the standard young, dumb, not very good A-10 pilot things, and down range when Afghanistan was hard for different reasons. It's not like Vietnam combat. It's not any of the major combat that we've written books about. But it was incredibly difficult for different reasons. But as far as that one, then about halfway through the time there, when I was still a lieutenant, I was told, if you're 500, the jet's going away. If you're 500 hours, if you're experienced and have been on station for greater than a year, you're PCSing. But you're PCSing, but there are no A-10 assignments anymore, period, dot. So that was when I actually got the word. The verbal that I got was I was going back to Laughlin to teach pilot training. But then we come home in October. I don't even reconstitute because about a month, maybe 2 months before, 2 months before I got offered, to go to the Viper for a Viper TX, me and another guy that was deployed with us, Moose Dreyer. So he was, old Moose.
Old Moose.
Dude, what a guy. What a guy, that guy.
Great. Phenomenal human being.
Absolutely. So me and most of the guys, and then as I'm walking out the door to go get in an A-10 and fly very slowly back across the pond back to Moody, Moose just goes, Flash, it's official, we're going to the Viper. And I then thought about that for 11 hours while sitting in my A-10, about my A-10 career being over, and how I felt about it. Even though I kind of picked it because they did offer it to me. It was either that or go to pilot training, so it wasn't much of a choice.
Right.
But as far as that's concerned, yeah, that was the one assignment. So about a year and 8 months operational for the A-10. So a little under 3 years with B course is how long I flew the Hog. It's still, however, the most most hours I have in an aircraft based off the time around the sun in Afghanistan.
That's wild. It's funny too because Moose. Correct me if I'm wrong. I'm pretty sure Moose is going to be a dentist. That was like his plan, yes. And then turned fighter pilot.
Yeah, and so he destroyed his collarbone in SOS, or else he was going to be a weapons officer in the Hawk. He was like, He was going to like, I think he was going to like 11 Bravo or something like that. But who knows?
That's funny because I did an MC-12 deployment.
Yep.
But part of my training, normally I do it at Beale. I went TDY down to Yuma, Arizona, lovely Yuma, in January. And like normally, like the training was taking like 2-3 months for guys to get through. And we went through and they counted every sortie. It was, 4-hour sorties. Every sortie was 2 syllabus rides. But Moose showed up down there because we were doing some integration with the Hogs and Seals. And he was telling me that. And then like fast forward, whatever it was, 6 months later, he's like, nah, I broke my collarbone or whatever. I was like, man, that's wild. So,
yep.
Yeah. Man, small world. So what was difficult about Afghanistan at that time period? I got a guess or two. What was the challenges?
The challenge was when we got there, you could not impact a building with a weapon. That's
challenging.
A structure. So you could not drop a bomb that would have any frag or any collateral damage against a structure. So anything that you did had to be out in the open, except that the gun in the A-10 was classified as a zero CDE weapon, like direct fire weapon. So we didn't drop very many bombs outside of task force. Kind of going after high value targets and individuals. We didn't drop a whole lot of bombs on things like blowing up buildings or anything like that. We shot a lot of gun. So kind of doing some of that stuff, but the ROE and just the overall ambiguity of the time. So around 2013 was when they started, FOB right, like in the Kunar Valley, far east side of Afghanistan. That's when they started to sort of close down a lot of FOBs. I think they closed down something like 40 to 50 FOBs. While we were like the tiny ones, like we're talking like all the, like they were retrograding back to the big ones, like Shank, Salerno, and Kabul, like going back home to kind of just have these large operating bases versus like the ton of little FOBs that are out there. So they started retrograding and then starting to man these areas with more Afghan National Security Forces, Afghan National Army, and things of that nature. So there's a lot of troops in contact that I was called to that I would show up and there was no American anywhere in the vicinity. And it was all telephone games. So it was radio in Farsi, in at like their native language, to interpreter at a talk, down to a JTAG. Let's get a Predator overhead. Let's do this. And then now I show up as an A-10 guy, as a troops in contact, and we're sitting there, it's like troops in contact, very time sensitive. And now I got to wait. And what I'm being told on the radio is people are getting shot at and are active and are dying. And you're just like, okay, I don't doubt that that is the case, but you have to survey the situation and you just have to kind of show lethality by restraint, if you will. And by just making sure that you do this right the first time if you can. And then also just be like, you know what? No, I'm not going to release that weapon, or I'm not going to just roll in and do a bunch of shows of forces and put myself into a dangerous situation. And I'm glad to say the majority of time it worked out well for me. There were times that I didn't handle those situations well and did some things that could have gone very poorly. So just difficult things, but that was the entire squadron. So everybody was kind of doing the same thing. Guys who had been there a lot really, really developed me well on how to act in a situation with limited information and ambiguity. So that was what was the most difficult about the entire thing, was showing up to a situation that is tailor-made A-10 troops in contact and just being like, okay, the best thing I can do is just sit and not shoot.
Man. Yeah, because, the adrenaline's pumping, fangs are through the floor. It is young. Always impressive to hear. It's like there seems like there's more. I mean, there are a lot of A-10 videos on YouTube with troops in contact, right? And like the world is melting but beneath them. And those flight leads are just always like cool, calm, and collected, just directing, the fight and moving, trying to move the information back and forward so they can impact the fight, as fast as they can. not an easy thing to do. And as we talked about in the beginning, you know, the average age that of a formation, maybe you got the squadron commander out there and the youngest wingman, and you got an average age of like 30 in that formation. That if you're talking Afghanistan, and you end up killing a bunch of civilians, which obviously is a very, very bad thing, but the strategic and geopolitical impact of that is just huge.
Absolutely. And that was the thing that was preached to me by our weapons officer and wing weapons officer, Lorenzo Harris, is just a huge mentor of mine. I think he's, some days he's still in the Air Force, some days he's not. great guy. But he was just sitting there, and he was the guy who kind of taught me. He's just like, dude, you, Flash McVay, have the opportunity to make, like, have the distinct opportunity to potentially ruin this Afghanistan war. And he's just like, if you do the wrong thing, then this can have political ramifications and strategic ramifications. This is a strategic, like, war of an infinite game, if you will, if anybody's ever heard of that. And we have the opportunity to lose the game. And then like, I remember a lot of guys kind of talking to us as being like, I don't think any of us are going to win the war, this deployment. So don't go into a situation thinking that you're going to do so.
Yeah, that's a great perspective to have, because you will only lose it, and you're not going to make that big of a change, unfortunately. But you can absolutely lose it with one trigger pull or one pickle button press in the wrong spot when the thing. And yeah, dude, like obviously the stories are out there. I think it was the squadron commander and the weapons officer or DO, or both of them were patches. They were a guard unit. Remember they strafed the Canadians on the bridge out, you know, and like that was a prime example of dudes who just, I think, wanted to get in the fight and wanted to do something that had been a slow deployment. And it's just fangs to the floor, and they end up killing some allied forces who were doing live fire exercises, obviously in Afghanistan, but they just, someone's shooting down there, and then this went after it. So it can go south really quickly.
Absolutely.
Dude, so hog deployment, and then you come back, and then you transition to the Viper. What was it like going from the hog to the Viper?
A lot of fun.
Besides amazing.
A lot of fun. it was amazing. man, I was bad at air-to-air. I couldn't. The speed was relative. I thought that I was going to have issues with the increase in speed. Hog or flying around, like, we have two power settings, like idle and like land and go. so anytime you're airborne, you're pretty much just in max the entire time. No AB. I thought that was going to be a problem. It wasn't. The good thing about the A-10 is I had a guy in B course tell me that, you've heard this in CAS before, is it's like, you don't need to write down anything on the 9-line. It's like, I'll feed you the data. It's like, just fly in formation and be ready. And I was like, okay, yeah, I can do that. And then I had a guy at B course tell me, he's just like, actually, Flash, to be perfectly honest with you, the only reason you are here is because I cannot physically reach over and hit your pickle butt. And he's like, if I could use your weapons and fly your A-10, I would not need you. I was like, oh, okay, sounds great. But I am here, so teach me. So as far as coming over to the Viper, I could do number two things really, really well. Like, I was a flight lead in the A-10, and I was like, cool, so I can be number two. So obviously coming in back into the wingman game, I was pretty good. So it didn't go poorly for me as far as learning how to be a Viper pilot all the way up until I got to my time at OSAN. And then when I got into the FLUG, I got absolutely exposed. It was just like, I didn't know how to do any air-to-air. Did not really do any of that God's eye view, picture building, essay around outside of just like that one situation. Because in the A-10, pretty much the entire thing was me and 12 miles of earth that I just had to go put weapons down on. But now when I'm up in a Viper, like doing seed or doing air to air, is I got me and 90 to 120 miles of DCA lane that I got to have essay on and predict the next flow, watch maneuvers and things like that. And I couldn't do that very well. And it took a pretty long time to kind of get that. But at the same time, man, it was fun. It was just like a new mental stimulation and things of that nature that I was really enjoying, even though I wasn't necessarily enjoying it on the day to day.
Yeah, getting kicked in the teeth. But I would imagine too, your upgrade into as a flight lead in the Viper, I'm guessing was probably fairly quick, whereas because you were an A-10 flight lead, and I know you're going to get your standard reps and things like that, but usually you're going to be a wingman for, you know, if you go to Korea, you're going to be a wingman probably for, you know, 10 months at least, yeah. You know, maybe 12 months before you're doing it. Was that similar to your timeline or?
No, 3 months.
Yeah, so you're not getting... You're not getting a whole lot of time, like just doing air to air stuff and building that. You probably got a couple DCA rides or something like that.
Yeah, it was like, and then when I was flying DCA as a wingman, I was like, this is great. Stay visual, shoot what one tells you to shoot.
Right.
I was like, I can do that. And so it was almost like I faked it until I made it a little bit. And there was like, yeah, this guy's ready for the flug. There's not much else he's doing as a wingman. And I was just like, okay, yeah. And I kind of lulled myself into thinking that as well. But I didn't realize the number of decisions that happen at the flight level in that mission, in those mission sets. Again, the things in the A-10, incredibly difficult cast scenarios and cast situations that we were in, but those were just different. And it wasn't anything that I was necessarily prepared for. So it was like 3 months. I showed up in like August of 2014 after the TX. And then I think I started I did one flood ride before Christmas and then came back from Christmas at Osan to do the rest of my flood. So about 3 to 3.5, 4 months of wingman time.
Dude, yeah, that's fast and furious. And comparison wise, I don't know if we talked about on the bro chat you were on, but I know Bender's talked about it because I was talking to Dojo, who's a former F-35 pilot. He was saying that, he was a former F-30 demo pilot, but he was an F-15E dude. And he was saying seeing B coursers come out of the F-35, that their situational awareness is comparable to like where a four-ship flight lead would be in a fourth-gen platform. Maybe not airmanship. That's according to Bender. It sounds like there's some airmanship things that are kind of spicy, which you're just not doing. They don't give as many reps doing things that you had to do as a fourth-gen wingman with seeing and being visual. But would you say that's a fair statement? Like, fifth gen wingman coming out, being able to run a lane or is it any different?
It is different. I agree with the statement that they're tactical inside of the airspace. Situational awareness is higher because but the other argument that I make, so I also like to do this exercise, is I will argue for the wingman and against them, and trying to defend the same, like defend them both with the same amount of passion. And so this one will be for them. I agree. I think these wingmen on a tactical level are far and away better than I was when I was their age. I think they have more access to teaching tools. I think they have a little bit more access to higher end tactics. I think guys just wouldn't tell me the higher end tactics because it wasn't my prerogative as a wingman. Like when I was growing up. But now, like, I think they just have higher SA on the tactical sense and in the actual mission sets that they're doing. The argument on the flip side of that is the jet gives you that SA. It's like, that is not because you went out and got it and you know how to parse and piece the right amount of SA and the comm and all the different things together. And your airmanship is so good that flying the jet is second nature. No, it's presented in front of you. It's just like, yeah, I knew it was a three-grip champagne. You're like, how? It's just like, because all of it is right there. And obviously, as you know, the Viper is like, I can't tell that. I just have to listen to the comm and kind of piece that together myself. So it's both sides. They have higher SA, but it is also a better tool that is given to them to gain that SA in the fifth gen world.
Yeah, so having those tools, I'm making an assumption that will make them more lethal. You think that's a fair statement?
Yes, that's fair.
Yeah, because now when it comes to battling down some big threats like double-digit SAMs and other fifth-gen platforms, like you have to have those to be survivable.
Yeah,
never having flown a fifth-gen platform, but
oh yeah, I always say that in the F-35 is all the things I was bad at in the F-16. Because it was hard to do with the Viper, is easy to do with the Panther. So it's like shoot two on a short skate. Like if you can't shoot two on a short skate, then like, dude, you are like, we can't have it. And it's just like, that was like a badge of honor to be able to do that on a majority basis. Like, if I was greater than 50, like baseball, like if I was batting greater than 300 on short skids shooting two, like, I'm in the Hall of Fame, man. I was like, I became a weapons officer off of batting 320. And it's like, so, but in the Panthers, just like, dude, that's gotta be 100% every time.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting to hear, you know, so, I mean, technology is amazing, but I jump forward just a little bit to the old F-35. You go Osan in the Viper, obviously, for those who don't realize it's an F-16 and A-10 base, but you're flying the F-16 there. When do you go to weapons school?
Right after Osan.
Okay, so you spent 2 years at Osan?
A little bit over. I was going to do three. We ended up doing 2 years and 4 months before I left in January of 17 to go to weapons school.
That's not a lot of time in the old Viper before going to weapons school. How was that?
It was tough.
Yeah.
I don't know. You'd have to ask some of the instructors, which I'm still pretty good friends with them to this day, but like, they knew I was the A-10 guy coming in, that's for sure. And they knew that the other one was I came in knowing that this was I was going to be behind, and it made me work harder.
Growing businesses and finance professionals, you need Bill Spend and Expense, the free-to-use spend management software. It's powered by the Bill Divvy Corporate Card, which helps growing companies scale with credit lines of $500 to $15 million, automated expense reports, and as many virtual cards as you need. For a limited time, get $500 when you get started with Bill Spend and Expense. Request a demo at bill.com/get500. Terms and conditions apply. Advertised credit ranges are not guaranteed and are determined at approval. Card issued by Cross River Bank, member FDIC.
The hard part about weapons school was that I had never done seed before, and sorry, Osan, you didn't do seed.
Stings for those guys.
Stings a little bit. I'm sorry, man.
It was
a nice set of academics.
I did see a wild weasel post from Osan not too long ago.
Oh, still doing it.
I mean, I've never been there, but I just hear you guys talk about it. I'm like, whatever.
It might be getting better. I got 6 years of stale data. They might be awesome now. But the guys that did teach me there, that was more of a joke, not as disparaging. But going to weapons school, it's a seed course. And especially because they knew that I had never done seed before, and I came from the A-10, and I was going to Shaw, which is upwards of it's the largest seed wing in the world, F-16 seed wing in the world. And so as far as like going to Shaw and being a weapons officer there, like, I needed to have credibility. And so guys did take me under their wing, and that was the course. Was I busted every single ride. I went to a triple X ride on every single seed ride, no matter how good I did. But I needed that. So as far as going to weapons school after 2 years and 4 months, I don't think that my time was any more difficult than the other 11 dudes in my class. But as far as going, it was just different because of my background. I was the only guy who hadn't always flown the Viper.
Right.
So that was the...
I mean, I was like, most guys at that point probably were, you know, they probably did an assignment like 18 months at Kunsan and then went to Shaw for 3 years. And then, you know, so they had a lot of reps. They probably had, you know, deployment in the Viper. So just a lot of time and familiarity. Not that you didn't at that point, but again, that's still it's a lot of changes really fast. And SEED, Suppression of Enemy Air Defenses, very complex mission set, which we'll talk a little bit more.
Absolutely.
In a bit.
Absolutely.
But what can some admin pieces? Can you explain the triple X ride and what does that mean? And I just remember going into doing WIC support and seeing the Dos Equis sign out there, and it was like always lit up. So can you talk to me, admin wise? What's a triple X ride? How much stress is always there hanging over your head? What is it like?
Well, if it gets bad enough, your next sortie could be your last one every day. And so like, that's the big thing is getting washed out of the course is always a threat. And then, man, you just don't want to bring the class down. Like that was my biggest fear, was that I was going to be so bad because I just didn't know stuff, that I was going to be a detriment to the class, because you're flying together. So when I was number one, I had a classmate as number three, sometimes as number four. So if I was number three for number one in a seed ride, and I was like, then they were teaching me how to fly a seed for the very first time. And I'm like, man, if we don't do good, we both fail. And that was my biggest fear, was that someone was going to fail a ride because I didn't know how to do something. So that was what maybe kind of worked a little bit harder. But as far as the triple X ride, so let's say you have seed one. It's a syllabus ride. You go out there, not good enough, going to see this one again. The next ride is seed one X. So just a syllabus denominator that you're on an X ride that you busted your last one. You're sitting on a bust, which also has a little bit of supervision associated with it. And then that one, also not good enough, dude. You're going to see it again. Now you're on double X. They light up the Dos Equis sign. You walk in and you just look up there. It's like, yep, that's lit up for me. And then if that one doesn't go well, then you go to a triple X ride. So triple X rides, which I also have a funny story about triple X ride. Kind of in keeping with the trend of like IFS. But as far as if you bust that one, then you go to a triple X ride. And they actually just like put a piece of paper with another X up on the Dos Equis sign. And then that ride, if you bust that one, you're going to a P ride with the commander. Like you're going to a progress ride. And the P ride can be, yep, he's going to continue with the course. He or she is going to continue with the course. Or yep, he or she is going to be done and go from there. So the triple X ride as you go through is just denoting that you are not nailing it on this sortie and kind of going from there. So as far as that's concerned, the funny story about it is the last day of weapons, like weapons phase for me, before you get into weapon school integration, the weapons phase, if you get through weapons, you are almost home free at weapon school. And I went to a triple X ride on my last day of weapons before integration. That usually denotes a P ride. But my instructors, okay. It was Deuce Dufresne, came up to me and just goes, Flash, this is a triple X ride. It is not a P ride. And it showed me what he meant by that was he's like, you need to see this one again. We're going to teach you more stuff. And they were like literally squeezing every ounce of juice they could out of this course to teach me things. But they wanted me to know that I was not in danger of failing the course. So then even that almost made me work even harder than to show up on a P ride. But yeah, so that's the triple X ride. It's just failing it three times, going to a triple X ride. Next ride, if you don't pass this one, dude, you're going with the commander and it's a P ride.
The one aspect that I think it takes a while for people to get used to, but it just becomes commonplace. One, you know, from day one of ROTC or the Academy, you're getting racked and stacked. And, you know, everything you're doing is being stratified. There's a number one, there's a number last. Everything is being graded, whether you know it or not. And that just carries on through. The other aspect of it, too, that I think was like a really big motivator to me that I think some people find surprising who don't come from the fighter pilot world or the pilot world in general. But like weapons academics or weapons tests that you would do once a week or maybe it's once a month, whatever it might be, that frequency, like those test scores are posted right outside the vault where everyone can see it, you know, and it is a motivator when you're at the bottom of the list because you don't want to be the wedge. And those things too, like, I mean, you remember high school or whatever, middle school, even college, like if you fail the test and some people are shy about it, they don't want to talk about it. Dude, like everyone in the squadron knows that you busted a ride and this is an X ride or this is no kidding, a Dos Equis neon sign lit up and they light the X's up as you go. Like it's just something that is an important part of the culture. It's not to shame or ridicule. I mean, it was a motivating factor. Yeah. I mean, like I would prefer that not be me anymore. Like, how do I unwedge myself? Not that it's necessarily being the wedge. Like that's just part of it. And again, you know, busting a ride, maybe it was still decent, but you're just going to get some more training out of it. I don't know. You've been a weapons officer. So you've handed out many an X ride.
Yeah.
it's come full circle. Just writing in your little notebook.
Yeah. I like to do it with a smile on the face though, a little bit. I'm just like, hey man, this is just another opportunity to learn. I promise. I was like, you're going to be better for it. But yeah, no, I completely agree. It's like you put it up there and everyone knows. And then at the same time, like triple X rides was class rallying time. It was like, what do you need? Like, what do you need? Like, I'll write your brief for you. You can practice your brief. There'd always be like two or three guys. Whenever I was on an extra, man, my class is awesome. I can't say enough about those guys. Is the experience that we had and the guys that were good at seed kind of made me who I was today. And just getting up to their level by the end of the time I was there just let me kind of jump from the beginning. So triple X rides are also a good time for rallying around a team that I've also taken like into leadership stuff going forward.
Yeah, and that aspect of it too that I really think is important, because one, it, you know, the team is there, and like you're in the trenches, right? Like while it's just training, yeah, you're simulating being in the trenches for later on down the road.
Absolutely.
But it also removes those barriers to learning. Like whereas you might learn, you're definitely learning a few things when you're on that X ride or why you're doing it. And while it, making it more public and out front, I think makes it, it's going to make it a lot easier to share and talk about. Like, yeah, man, I busted that ride. Boom. Here's what I did. You know, you just download all the info to make everyone better. Absolutely. In the process. And that's the name of the game, is just making everyone better.
Absolutely. And it was limiting the number of the repeat mistakes across the class. I mean, everybody talks about that. It's like by the end of it, everyone had made 1,000 different mistakes. But if the entire class is making 1,000 of the same mistake over and over and over, then that's a sign of a poor class. And so we had a long list of errors that we had solved that were all different, which was what I was told later on was the mark of a good class.
Okay, apples and oranges comparing a pilot training class to a weapons school class, but I do think there's some parallels. Like even, you know, being a FAPE, again, I'm not comparing the two, but I do think there are parallels.
You absolutely can.
With like, you know, if you would do a ride with a student and you see the same mistakes over and over again, every single class, but telling a student, you know, something, and then what you're doing is watching to see if that information gets disseminated amongst the class so they don't make that same mistake. And if you're going to go to pilot training, the worst thing you can be is play I have a secret and then carry that mentality forward, because instructors are watching. Like, do you share your lessons learned? Because then they're going to come back and talk about it in the, you know, flight commander's office. And you're looking to see who's the team player, who's out for it for themselves. And then, you know, does the class get better? And there's definitely a class, you're like, man, this class was awesome. Everyone makes mistakes, but they like rally around it, make it better. It was actually Academy class was like my favorite class. And now it's kind of cool to see those guys out in the road in a different life. So, you know, Academy guys always get a bad rap.
Yep. We're not so bad. We have like a modicum of social skills coming out, but it's not much, but yeah.
Every now and then. Dude, so obviously you go to Shaw to be the weapons officer of the Tigers. Now it's kind of interesting to hear you say like, obviously no real seed experience and then go into the largest seed wing. I mean, when you walked out of weapons school, going to Shaw, like what was going through your mind? Like, is there a lot of stress or is there a weight on your shoulders to like go now teach seed with really only having done seed at weapons school? Or I mean, is that even a factor?
Yeah. Again, same thing. So I was just like, it's my job to make this squadron combat deployable and combat ready, to go fight if in the event we're called upon, which we almost were called upon when I was there. We were called upon and turned off. But yeah, so that was a little bit, but the stress wasn't, like, was I going to be good enough? I knew I had some game and I knew that I could teach, going through weapons school will do that. And it's just like, I had a confidence that I could do it. The biggest one was just, I didn't know. I had never been the guy to the young wingman. Like, I was always the person learning, and now the training was not about me. And so I had to be the person that the training was all about everybody else. And I didn't know if I could do that. And as it turned out, it was a challenge, and just trying to figure out how to reach every single person in the squadron to make them the best fighter pilot they could be, was a task in itself. But as far as like showing up to Shaw, I found out that I was better than I thought I was. I was like, but at the same time, it was kind of one of the, and weapons school told me that. There's like, hey man, you're going to find out that this actually prepared you pretty good. But as far as like showing up there, being able to teach and just kind of some of the things that happened, was the things that were difficult about Shaw had nothing to do with like teaching dudes how to fly seed. It was more about just getting a squadron prepared to be and developed to be good fighter pilots. And but yeah, it was great. As far as professional life at Shaw, it was a decent time.
What were some of the difficulties in preparing a squadron to be ready fighter pilots?
There was some disagreements on from the lower level, like the middle level, I would say, at the tactical level. This was around the time when there was just a shortage and you just had a bunch of young wingmen. We'd also just come back from a deployment, and or the squadron had. I did not go with them, obviously. I was at weapons school. But when they came back, they PCS'd all their experience. And so when we were told that we were potentially going to go to combat, was we didn't have the people to do that. Like, we didn't have the qualifications or the experience. So at the time, the solution to that was just to kind of do these speeding and push through upgrades. And I just don't believe in that. I believe in very methodical, deliberate development that is that cannot be rushed. And you have to get repetition in certain things. Like, you can do some things to get repetition very quickly, but you have to have a requisite amount of experience so that the things I can't necessarily teach you, you will still just be able to conceptually bring back to the forefront of your brain in combat in a stressful situation. And I think that just takes time. So when they were saying, it was just like, hey, this guy's got 120 hours, he's going to go in the flug. And then as soon as he was done with the flug, roll right into an IPUG, it was something I disagreed with. But that was what we had to be done. So I understood it because we had to have people to fly as one and three, but it was something I disagreed with. And the back and forth between the upper tactical positions of authority and leadership, commanders, DOs, and all these different things to get the things they needed to go to combat. And me at the level of sitting there looking at the bros and just being like, hey, if we rush this guy along, like, he's going to fail in combat, which could mean failure of the mission, and it also will mean his life. And right. So that was the balance, and having to figure that out was the most difficult thing to get folks ready for, was to listen to both ends of the spectrum, understand both, and then also take this message and portray it in a manner down to the bros when even they might not agree with what's overall happening.
Interesting time period, because I remember from, you know, I was doing demo and kind of removed, I think, during that time period from what was going on in a lot of the squadrons. But a lot of my buddies who in the other squadron, I think in very similar situations where they hadn't even completed the full flug, they had a bunch of, top off rides to complete, and they got moved right into the IPUG.
Yep.
And several of them who, or a couple of them who are, FAPES, so they already had some experience saying, like, dude, I am not ready, which there's always that piece of like, hey, I don't think I'm ready for this. But then it was a legitimate, like, dude, I know I'm not ready to go into this. Like, I have just finished the flug. And that was kind of echoed. So that was an interesting time period. No idea what's going on now and if that's been fixed. But I think during that time period too, like, I think specifically I remember sitting at a table with some people who were Tigers that turned down going to weapons school, and they were sitting in front of the man of why they did not want to go to weapons school, which is, yeah. It's a whole other conversation in itself, but I think it was indicative of that time period, at least, where guys are getting pushed through. And then kind of what you touched on earlier too, like, they're assessing where their life, what their life goals are and what their life objectives are. And for those listening who aren't familiar, like, I think turning down weapons school, that's just something that's really just never happened.
Yeah.
In the history, it was one of those things that, like, that's where you're always shooting for and trying to attain. And so this paradigm shift is occurring.
Yep.
Culture, everything's, there's changes. And again, I don't know if that's still true, if you're seeing that or what your thoughts are on that.
I mean, right now in the F-35 community, the applicant pool for weapons school is high. I think it's still a goal for people, and it's just another step in development. Like, at when you were talking and saying, like, I can't compare being a FAPE in a pilot training room to weapons school. Yes, you can. Is they're the exact same overarching conceptual environment. Is you have instructors and you have students. And you are just trying to get those students to create a cohesive team to develop together. And so when you're looking at some of these things, in the event that you do things such as rush development, you then break down the cohesiveness of that team. And when people, I had some people at Shaw, which I sat there and talked to this with numerous people, is they said, hey, I know that I'm only in this upgrade because there's no one else and we have to. And there is, again, I kind of disagreed with them, but at the same time, it was their feelings and their perception. And so that is true to them. So when there was like, I just have to be in this upgrade and I don't think I did good enough to pass that ride, but you passed me because we have to and we're on a timeline. And so actually what I saw was guys getting rushed into upgrades, then their confidence went down as they finished their upgrade. When your confidence is supposed to go the other direction as you're going through an upgrade,
right.
Like you are developing and you are getting better and your job, your satisfaction, fulfillment in your job is by knowing that you're doing the right things to get better. And that when you are put into these situations, you're ready. And so because they had been rushed through a little bit, they felt unready to go do these things. And then what we were being asked to do was they were actually, it was lowering their morale passing upgrade rides. And
wow.
Like that was a real thing. And it was a very interesting, and this is something that I just love personally, enjoy studying, is just how that human behavior and how that situation occurred, where guys were just like, I'm passing these upgrade rides, which is generally a good thing in the fighter pilot community. And it was actually lowering their morale to the point where they were done with their upgrade at the IPUG level and were like, hey, would you like to go to weapons school? And they were like, no. And so I drew like a very linear correlation to those two events, to those two types of things occurring. And again, 1,000 factors, contributing factors to all those things that we won't even broach, but it happened. I would say at least 3 people that I had that I talked to, that was a direct thing that they were looking at. It was like, my morale went down by finishing this upgrade. And one guy to the point where he separated from the Air Force earlier than what we would normally think, and actually got out of his commitment because of the stress that it caused.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's, man, there are a lot of dynamics. I just remember that time period because fighter pilot shortage, fighter pilot crisis, whatever you want to call it. And then I think you eloquently put it in the bro chat, like, when is it no longer a crisis? Like, if we just keep calling it a crisis, like now it's just like it's the status quo. It's the norm.
It's the norm.
I forget how you said it, but yeah, this is just, we've accepted it. But manning for sure in the fighter pilot world is a challenge for a variety of reasons. Flash wrote a very eloquent article on War on the Rocks about retention, which again, I linked it in the bro chat the first time. I'll do it again here. I think in the first bro chat, you said you were going to write the follow-up to that.
Yeah. I have yeah. Draft. I am on V3, so I broke my word to you, Raina, and I deeply apologize.
You're busy.
I am, but I'm on V3 of the drafts. I'm the projo for our summer deployment. That's taken up a little bit of my time, and then no excuses, but like a champion. But I am. There's, as we talked about in the first time, is like that first article was more about what I went through and what a lot of people kind of have gone through, taking my experience and putting it in the broader scope of demographics of the entire Air Force or the entire fighter pilot community. And then the next one was, what do you do about it? So that's what I'm writing at the moment. And I think some of the things that we look at is all these different things. The world is changing and our policies have not. And so we kind of have to just get up with the times, if you will, to get after this the norm of the fighter pilot shortage.
Times are changing. That's the piece. I think, you know, we could go on for this days and days, but it's amazing just comparing everyone has their problems, right? So blanket statement, but some of the stuff that we do is just like mind boggling. Like if it takes me 2 hours to log in to do a 3 minute task, like a 3 minute task without fail will take me 42 minutes every single time. 100%. Like it's just simple stuff. Like, all right, I can't do this. And that's admin, right?
Yep.
And it's, we're just not even scratching the surface, but.
Oh yeah.
So, all right, real quick. We'll dive from that. Cause I don't want to keep eating up all your time, but I do want to talk. So you go back and you teach at weapons school, right? And then out of that, you transitioned to the F-35. Did you know you're going to go back and teach at the weapons school? How does that work?
I did. I knew I had an idea that after Shaw, I was going to go back and teach in the Viper weapons school. Just a potential that was going to be my next assignment. It was also what I wanted to do. So at Shaw, going through the entire thing, started to have some things in personal life that were not congruent with being able to stay at Shaw. So kind of had to get out of there, kind of had to get out of that environment as far as what we needed to do. So I asked if I could go back and teach the weapons school early, if there's any way we could get back there early. But then when they came back, they was like, hey, you can go back to Nellis early, but we're actually going to have you teach in the F-35. So I was like, okay, sounds great. Literally anything. That was very cool to go to the F-35, but I was like, Near Rocks was depart this environment and get out to Nellis. So going to teach the weapons school was a thing. Teaching in the F-35 was not something that I had anticipated up until about the 3 to 4 months prior to actually going.
Dude, going to teach at the weapons school, but then going to teach in F-35, I imagine there was a few challenges because you got a TX, right? And then you got to be at the level of a weapons school instructor. What was that like?
Tough again.
Just pain.
The thing about that one is this is now what you're prepared to do. The development that I had gotten over time and then just things of that nature and kind of talking about some of the how to handle these situations that you find yourself in is when I show up to the weapons school is, again, there's a best instructor, there's a worst instructor. We don't necessarily know who they are, but there is one. When I first showed up, I was the worst. Like, I was the worst instructor because I had never flown the airplane before. I actually effectively did weapons school again with Mostert and Wood in 19 Bravo. But as far as like just coming back there and doing it, is I had to find the value I could provide. And so when you're looking at like the humble, approachable, credible motto and credo of a weapons officer was a humbling experience. But what I could do was I could make myself approachable to the WUGs, to the weapons officer upgradees that I had gone through weapons school before. And now I'm effectively doing it again with you. And I could help them navigate the stresses of that course from the capacity that I was currently in while learning how to fly the airplane. So I was not going to be the Joust Breeze and the Rags Seltzer and some of the guys that could just sit there and just tell dudes everything about the 3-1 and the ins and outs of flying the F-35. But what I could do is I could tell them how to handle going back to the WUG dorm and writing your brief at night and interacting and disagreeing with an instructor and things of that nature and kind of go from there. And as far as the humbling experiences, I think I've been told this before in my life and I like to live by it is the most arrogant thing you can do to actually not speak up when you have value and let someone fail. And so what I was basically doing was I was being humbled by only providing the value that I had is like, and shutting up when you don't. So as far as like just showing up is finding those times when you were valuable, sitting back and learning the entire time, inserting yourself into a situation that you actually can provide some value and then sitting back. And then over time, I got decent. Like you're around that caliber of people. And then also just in the environment that you're just always talking, like what you were just talking about, there's not a whole lot of queep at weapons school. There's not a whole lot of admin at weapons school where you're doing a bunch of different stuff. There's just tactics for the most part. And you're just around it all the time and you're picking up everything and you're learning from everybody. Supposedly the best instructors in the world. I believe that everybody else was. I don't necessarily put myself in that category. But at the same time, it's just like you're just learning from all these guys and you get good over time. And then at the end of my time, I was able to be the guy that stood up in front of a lot of people and actually talked like, okay, this guy's got some credibility in the F-35 and kind of go from there. But the journey from start to finish was an experiment in human development in itself. So,
dude, Flash, we're getting close to the end here, but I got a couple questions for you. And one of which I want to ask because I think you're the perfect guy to ask this question. And this gentleman, he was prior enlisted, wanted to be a pilot, got picked up for OTS. So just off the get-go, I think for those, like, that's a really challenging thing to do, to get picked up while enlisted. Like, there's a lot of hurdles jumping, and then he didn't become a pilot. He's going to go fly drones. And he goes, what's the stigma? What do you know? Pilots think of drone pilots? So curious to hear what you would say to him.
I think they're pilots. And they serve an incredible, niche capability that we have in the Department of Defense. Is as far as like the stigma that we have with drone pilots, I have a stigma about drone pilots that act like they should not be drone pilots and want to be fighter pilots, and think that they have to act a certain way to like prove their pilotness. That's where the stigma kind of comes into. But as far as just like my own personal and what a lot of people think is, it's like there's going to be, I make fun of guys that fly MQ-9s less than I make fun of guys who fly Strike Eagles, and less than I make fun of guys that fly sea models and things of that and things of that nature. So it's just different communities. But as far as going from enlisted to OTS to pilot training to being a drone pilot, first off, congrats to this individual. And then second, just like, go be good at your job, and the stigma isn't there. Because I'll tell you what, there was one story in Afghanistan, and if we have a little bit of time, we'll tell one war story if that's okay with you, Rain. But
dude, yeah. I don't want to take your time.
Oh, dude,
about story time, man.
I got some time for you, Rain. I got any time.
Yeah,
Bethany said,
clear the calendar.
Bethany said she'd pick the kids up from school today. but like the most combat additive situation that I had in Afghanistan was provided by an MQ-1. Was provided by a Predator. And so as far as stigma amongst drone pilots is you can create one for yourself, just like a fighter pilot can. But as far as that one, as being a UAV pilot, you provide an incredible resource and asset to the Air Force and DOD by flying that. Stick to that, do your job good, and there's nothing else for it.
Dude, I think that's perfect, especially the stigma, like you can create it yourself, because it could be anyone who does that. And it's like, dude, own what you do, be the best at what you do. As I'm same, like I remember, you know, doing OIR. So if you were zipping up into Syria and you knew there was a drone on station, you knew it was going to be a good day because you were going to do work.
I couldn't do my job.
Wasn't a drone on station. And if there wasn't one on station, now you're going to have to go build the pattern life, and you're going to have to convince them that these are the bad guys. But if there is a drone on station, it's been there for the last 12 hours, they already have the target sets built and they're just waiting for you to show up.
Yep.
So, dude, it is a force multiplier. And then, you know, in all reality, it pains me to say it, right? Like, we're only going to do more autonomous operations, and, you know, there's going to be less people in cockpits down the road. So it's probably the future.
It is.
To a certain degree.
It know? Is.
So, yeah, that's good. What's your Afghanistan story? I want to hear this.
That was a pretty good one. So Saigon 2-1 was the MQ-1. We get called to a pry. And just south of Kabul. But not here or there. Somewhere in Afghanistan. There I was.
Beautiful country.
Beautiful country this time of year.
Yeah.
But show up, and we're kind of building some SA on the way. And we get a 9-line in route, and they say, hey, there's just this many folks kind of around. And as soon as I show up, Saigon 2-1 is on station, and me and my flight lead, I was the wingman actually at the time, and we check on station, and there's like Saigon 2-1 on station. I think it was like 19,000 feet. I was like, cool. I don't like to go above 18,000 feet in the A-10, so wow, that's going to be great.
It's perfect.
It's going to be perfect. So when we show up, I guarantee you this guy was a former fighter pilot that then got sent to UAVs. potentially. But as soon as I showed up, he just goes, call and ready, steer 1511, Ibis A 9-line alpha. So he already had the 9-line and steer 1511 laser code. So he's putting out laser energy that I can slave my targeting pod to, hit laser spot track. And as soon as I do it, get the little container, and I see people underneath the targeting pod. And in all reality, in Afghanistan, that was probably about the second time ever that I was actually going to employ weapons that I actually saw what I was having to target. So again, like, roll in, we employ. These are bad people, by the way, confirmed. In fact, they were actively shooting and things of that nature. You can see that in your targeting pod. But as soon as I showed up, like, we had the 9-line, and within 90 seconds, we were eyes on and tally target and asking for clearance to employ. And that was given to us by Sajjan. So then as soon as we came off target, that one's done. He just goes, shift northwest corner of the clearing, steer 1511. It's like, okay. So just like zoom the targeting pod out, steer laser spot track again, and it just slaved to the northwest corner. And there again is people, and you can see them shooting. And now they're like running across back to where their former buddies were. And that happened four more times. And it was just like, there they are. And they provided all the targeting data for us. And we were able to win the day, if you will, in a very short amount of time because of the, force addition that they were. And as far as just like, they enhanced our lethality that day, and helped out. So as far as the MQ-1 is concerned, that was a dub, and what I initially think of those guys, and I see their capability. So when they don't perform up to that capability, that's when I start to, I'm like, dude, I've seen you do good before. You can do better.
I know what you're capable of. That's, yeah. I mean, you got a dude or two dudes or dudettes sitting there who are just building SA, and all they're doing right is just looking through a very nice camera.
Yep.
And they can see things. They're amazing. So it's a huge force multiplier.
And they're looking. That's
my one funny story from. Yeah, my one funny story is, I was over NC-12. I was over Kandahar. We're doing some base defense, and I happened to look down at the like most exact perfect moment ever in the history of time, as I watched an MQ-9 cartwheel down the runway into this massive fireball. I was like, well, I guess we're going to get extended here because there's one runway and we're not landing here.
Oh, no.
So I was like, I couldn't have timed it any better. I couldn't imagine landing those things. So again, like, they hand that off. For those who don't know, they hand it off. They're flying it somewhere in the world, you know, back in the United States, typically, and they hand it off to a crew that is on the ground at that airfield so they can do direct line of sight. They don't have a satellite lag. But landing that thing with just, I'm sure it's gotten better, but you're just 2D view, you know, like looking out front. Sounds absolutely terrifying.
Oh, yeah.
So put some wind in there, some gust. Like, huh?
That's a no thanks for me, Bob.
Yeah, hard nope thanks. Hard nope thanks, friend.
Yeah.
I'm gonna pass on
exactly.
That.
Exactly.
But yeah, never again. I mean, just be able to look out the window and see that happen. It was just like, dude, good thing there's no people there. But I think that one had started carrying GBU-12s.
Yeah.
At that point, you know, so then, you know, it's a whole other factor as that thing goes careening down the runway. But yeah, drones, man. What can you do?
Just out there, getting pissed on by gas.
That's right, man. Again, I'll go back to, like, you got to wonder, like, you ever, one day, right? I hope we find out, you know, you hear this Russian just telling the story of, like, what he was thinking when he's like, oh, yeah, like that cockpit audio going back and forth. Like, all right, here's what we're going to do.
I got to have it.
Here's what we're going to do. Yeah, it's like, could you imagine, Harry, man? Just going to pass over it about, you know, 500 feet back. And they're probably talking in meters. You're going to start dumping fuel, and we're just going to douse this thing. Like, what? What lieutenant came up with that idea? That's what it is.
Well, when I first saw it, I was just like, that. Just like you're talking about, I was like, I got to hear the cockpit video or the audio. But here's what I thought they were going to do, was that the next thing before they actually hit it, was that they were going to dump fuel on it, and then they were going to dump flares on it. And I was just like, oh, they're just going to light this thing on fire. I was like, they're going to give it a shot. And it's like,
could you imagine?
Oh my gosh. But that, first off, if they did that, that is some skill. And
that would have been,
that would have been some massive skill. But that was what I was like, oh, here it comes. It's like, here's what's going to happen.
Could you even do that?
I don't think you could.
You'd have to like have some like lead, like close trail formation.
Yeah. I don't think
you start dumping fuel and light it. I don't think, would it ignite?
I don't know. I don't think you could do it, but hey, you know what? I hope the Russians aren't watching this because they're going to try it.
I got an idea. We'll show them this time.
Hey, man, this guy named Flash gave me this idea to dump fuel and then light it on fire.
Like, could you? Yeah. Again, you know, I wonder, like, all right, I got an idea. This is how we're going to scare it. And also, like, what is the point in scaring a drone? You know, this stuff happened. Like, remember, was it it was a P3 in China. Yeah. Was it like, or was it early 2000s where the... hit the nose, the P3 had to divert into China.
Yeah.
Not what you want.
Not what you want. Yeah. Yeah, it's not...
Hard nope.
Nope. That's a no, that's a no for me. I'm not going to China.
But, jeez. Yeah, reckless stuff. What was your favorite aspect of flying the A-10, the F-16, and now the F-35? Which one would you go... Which one do you want to fly?
I want to fly the F-35. This is the okay. One. I think this is the mission sets that we're doing and the capability that the airplane has is just ridiculous. The way the future, like going in with the F-35 is I'm unsure what the future holds for manned fighter aircraft. I think the F-35 is probably going to be like one of the last ones that we probably build. I would say maybe like, I don't know, 3 to 4 more. But again, that's 500 years from now. We have no idea what the world's going to look like. But at least in my lifetime, I think the F-35 is going to be around for a while. It's still going to be pretty futuristic, if you will. So as far as picking one, the F-35, it's not that close. But as far as like the best part about flying all the things is just being able to have an impact at each of those stages. Like in the A-10, had an impact by going to Afghanistan, and the F-16, like to think I had an impact by furthering some tactics in the community and then just getting to teach dudes. And then in the F-35, I've gotten to have some, as I've gotten older, some really cool opportunities to kind of shape how the F-35 interacts inside of the greater picture. And shape how the military fights wars in the event that they happen. And hopefully they don't. But as far as like the best part about it is, I think my like going out and beating somebody in an airplane 1v1 is on the back nine, if you will. But I'm just starting to now kind of get into a little bit of a ramp up on being able to do other things outside of the cockpit. That is really cool. That I really enjoy. So those are the kind of the things. But yeah,
dude, awesome. Well, Flash, I got one more question for you, and then I'm gonna ask you. We're gonna say goodbye, but I'm gonna ask you to hang around afterwards for a There I Was story. Yeah. That keeps the lights on for my Patreon supporters and then the Apple Podcast subscribers.
I think I got an okay one for you.
Yeah, I'm sure you got a few. So again, yeah, if people want to check it out, that's what you know pays for all the subscriptions and things like that. But if you saw 15, 16-year-old Flash walking down the street today, is there any advice you'd give him? Tell him to do something different, change something. Would he listen to you? That's one I get is like, 15-year-old Flash, like 15-year-old Rain wouldn't listen to me. I'm like, that's probably a valid point.
Yeah, I would tell that kid some stuff. The first one I would say, kind of going back to the Air Force Academy story, is find some discipline. The biggest regret I have in my life is that I didn't play all 4 years of football at the Academy just because I didn't work hard enough. That was just poor and I hate it every single day. It was just based on being undisciplined, not doing your homework and not working hard at the sport you love, at an environment that they gave you the opportunity you wanted. And kind of squandered that one. So I would tell that 15, 16-year-old kid to just find some discipline And my parents were instilled that in me too. It was like that I was disciplined at home, but then when I was off on my own for about a year and a half, like I was like, I lost it. So anyways, that's what I tell them at the first one. The second one is, man, I really wish early in my career, the personal stuff at Shaw was, the Air Force has provided me some incredible opportunities, but it is not life. The Air Force is not life. I kind of mortgaged a little bit of my family to be a really good weapons officer. I wish I could go back and fix that. I think I could have been just as good of a weapons officer and a way better husband and father during those times. So I would go back and just kind of lay out these scenarios and go from there. I'm still married, happily. So that's great, because that's, I don't think we were ever in danger of really getting there. But at the same time, it's like, I was gone all the time. I volunteered for everything. I always stayed late. I was always on the phone, taking every single phone call and all these different things, and just misprioritizing the things that were at work than the things that were at home. So I would tell that kid to figure that out earlier, because you can, once I actually found a better balance, I actually became a better weapons officer. And I was actually able to teach students a little bit better about how to handle things outside of the military. Because what they were doing was they were coming to work and being phenomenal, and then they would go home and their home lives were disasters. And I was able to do a little better. So that would be the second thing that I would tell somebody. Third thing that I would tell myself. We're talking about myself again.
Yeah.
That's
sage advice, though, because the Air Force is going to squeeze every ounce. They're going to take everything they can out of you, and you have to meter that. And unfortunately, you know, often it's not, you have to learn it the hard way, you know, unless you catch it early enough.
Absolutely. So then the third thing, be less emotional. At the end of my time in the active duty, there were some career things that were going on. One that was out of my control, one that was kind of within my control. But as far as when I was handling things on whether I was going to separate or stay in the active duty, was just like you just said, the Air Force is going to try to squeeze every ounce out of you. And they were still trying to do that. I was trying to figure life out. And those two things, I didn't handle them very well. It was to the point where I already have a problem with authority. I have a massively high tolerant, like high threshold for leadership. And if you're in a position of leadership or a position of authority, like I feel that you have to earn it to your people every single day. And I just have just a pretty high threshold for it, which also leads to a little bit of a problem with authority, to be honest with you. It's got me in trouble a lot. It's okay though. But what I would say is just like leave emotion out of it. When things weren't going my way, there were certain days when I allowed like my mood and my stress of going through that time, because it's the most stressful time in your life trying to figure out a brand new career path. I mean, you've done it. Like you separated from the Air Force and you're forging this new path of podcasting and general aviation and all these different things, and still being around the aviation community and doing all these different things. But that's a shift from being in the active duty military. And that's a very stressful shift because it's unknown and you're scared that you're going to fail and things like that. And if you're making the right decision. And when I was going through that, I got like emotional with the people that had authority over me. And I wish I wouldn't have done that. But I would have liked to have coped ahead to be able to do that and just kind of keep your emotions in check and keep emotions out of professional situations because they have no real place. And I would have given myself that advice as well. So those three things. So be disciplined at an earlier age. Balance your life at an earlier age than before it becomes too late. And then when you have issues with people in positions of authority over you, just leave emotions out of it. Would be the three things I'd tell my 15, 16-year-old self.
Dude, I'd tell my 38-year-old self that as well. So sage advice. Flash, I appreciate you taking the time, man. I'm excited for you to hang around for a There I Was story. And just, again, man, thanks for sharing this. And hopefully we'll hear more Flash over on the Afterburn podcast. So Flash, thanks for joining me, man.
Dude, Rain, thank you again. Again, this is a huge honor to be able to be on this podcast. I've watched some of your guys' stuff, and you're killing it, man. Keep it up. You're reaching a lot of people. And just again, very honored to be considered to actually be on an episode with you.
Dude, well, I really appreciate it. It's humbling to hear that. And again, hopefully this helps one person out. That's like the name of the game, or makes someone
man, better. I hope so.
That's a win. Awesome. Thanks, Flash.
No problem.
Hey, thanks for listening to this episode. I hope you enjoyed it. As always, thanks to my Patreon supporters, and thank you for those who've taken the time to go over to Apple, Spotify, and now YouTube. Leaving comments, ratings, and reviews in the appropriate places, that helps the podcast out, and I appreciate each and every one of them, and I see each and every one of those. So thank you for taking the time. We'll see you next time. The Afterburn Podcast is a proud supporter of Guns, Gear, and Memorial Foundation, helping our veterans and their families when they need it most. To learn more, visit gunsgarin.com/rain.
Good news, bad news. All those spam and text calls you've been getting lately? Well, that's a result of your information having been sold by third-party data brokerages, or it's been stolen and sold to nefarious people. Ticketmaster recently had a data breach where 560 million users' information was stolen and sold in the dark web. This included their names, physical addresses, email addresses, credit card information, and much more. Best case scenario, this just ends with more annoying phone calls and text messages. Worst case, it's going to end in fraud and you're really going to be in the hurt locker. That's why I've been using a service called Aurora for over a year now. I've talked about it on the podcast before, but not only do they monitor the dark web and the internet for my information in case it is involved in a breach, they go right to work removing your information from these data brokerages. When I signed up, they identified over 60 that had my information and went right to work removing me from these data brokerages. Now, yeah, you could do this yourself, but each one of these data brokerages has its own policies and procedures, and I have no idea how you would even start trying to remove yourself from these services, let alone how much time that would take. But Aurora does that, as well as they offer a whole suite of tools to keep you safe, including a VPN, antivirus, password management, parental controls, and identity theft insurance. You get this all in one app, one place, so it's super simple. And you can do this with a 14-day risk-free trial. Super simple. And if you don't like it, you just cancel anytime. It's not complicated. At a minimum, you can take a look and see what information of yours is out there lurking on the web right now. Use the link down below in the description or go to aurora.com/afterburn and you get 14 days risk-free, cancel anytime, super easy, and take the first step in protecting yourself out there on the interwebs. That's the good news, by the way.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Driving plays a big part in driving the local economy. It helps us all get where we're going and creates good jobs close to home. At Synovus Energy, our refineries in Toledo and Lima are a reliable domestic source of gasoline, diesel, and jet fuel. Plus, more than 2,300 employees and contractors work for us here in Ohio. See how we're helping local communities move forward at synovus.com.